kicking around the idea right now of offering people, instead of that $80 in payment, we will put that $80 into a fund that we would give out as scholarships or as fellowships to journalism students to go out and do investigative work or whatever. It's a nonprofit thing, and that is resonating with people. It also helps us to generate content that we could then use.
Okay. James, I'll put that same question to you. Interesting, you talked about Politico. They have a completely open format in comparison to yours. I mean, you don't have to subscribe or do anything like that. And they actually have, what's interesting is when you go on their site, you get Canadian advertising. Uh-huh. You get TD, you get, those savings accounts from Edward Jones and whatnot. So how do you foresee, I mean, what role do you see advertising playing?
To answer that, Politico is I think served by Olive Media up here, or one of the ad servers, and they just have it. They're part of a channel, and
right.
So it's remnant space for them. We certainly are reliant on, or at least plan to be reliant on advertising, but not the traditional advertising. And we're not looking for Lexus and Mercedes and Best Western hotels. Our plan is, and it's we can certainly see it in Washington as a result of back in the early part of this decade or last decade with the Abramov scandal in Washington, companies and lobby firms realized that it was better to telegraph what they were doing. So actually, that sort of specific targeted advertising became a huge industry or growth industry. Many of those same rules have been brought in here during the Harper administration, and lobbyists and companies trying to do business with the government are having this same experience and are thus are therefore starting to advertise or at least telegraph their lobbying messages, and so that certainly was one of the target groups we were aiming at. We also want to, so there's companies trying to do business with the government. There's also an enormous growth in unions advertising, large associations like the nursing, the nursing union, the doctors, all wanting to get their voice into the debate. And they're seeing targeted, a niche publication or a niche certain news service as a good vehicle for it.
How many advertisers do you have at the moment?
We have four sponsors who are.
What's the difference between
a sponsor pays us a flat rate. Just it's basic. It's basic cash. It's not it's not dependent on page views or anything. It's a flat amount, and it stays there permanently on every page. And then we have a big box that. Is sold. There are 12 window, 12 spots in it, and I think currently we have seven advertisers using 9 spots. I think at this, if I remember the month.
Okay.
During the election, we were full. We also sell. We have a couple of email blasts that we do every morning and afternoon, and we sell a sponsorship at the top of that as well. And
sponsorship the way you want to go? Or would it be more lucrative if you could be filling these spots?
I think well-targeted sponsorship is whether it's more lucrative. It's more easily managed. It comes with less strings attached. It comes with less sort of requirements to produce reports and invoicing and whatever. It's a much happier relationship.
Okay.
And for us, we have we have one guy in sales. The sponsorship model works for us at this point.
Okay. David, I want to move on to you. It says on your website that the TAI remains with a bare bones budget seeking investors, advertisers, and funders. So you've gotten a lot of recognition for some excellent journalism. Is it still hard to find advertising?
Yes, it is, because we designed it to be almost advertising averse in some ways. I spent some time at Mother Jones magazine, and if you want to attract car ads, you don't run the story about the Pinto blowing up, which they did. And so the problem is that those values that I put up on the screen are not the values that are often associated with big ticket advertisers. The other problem that we built into the model was that we decided to go regional. And again, you have to go back to the mission statement. We wanted to change the conversation in a way that would have impact, that would affect people's lives. And what we saw was that enormous decisions are made at the provincial level that affect our lives. And yet most of the media covers either the national scene or this hyper-local. And so we deliberately created a regional publication. Also, BC had a problem, which is that the rural part of BC never talks to the urban part, and there's an enormous sense of alienation between those two worlds. And so again, the Tai'i, and you're seeing that this is a list of altruistic goals, the Tai'i wanted to try to kind of bind together those worlds. So for all those reasons, we created the website we did. There were reasons for it, but it didn't start with an advertising rationale. So then we decided, well, now let's see if someone will advertise once we had this thing up, right? And the first thing I ran into is what James pointed out, which is that smaller websites, especially early in their lives when their traffic is low, have a huge problem with cost of sale. You have to service your advertisers. You have to give them top service because they're used to getting it from large corporate advertising salespeople. So you have to give them that same level of service, and yet you can only charge one-tenth as much for the ad. And so we very quickly saw we were getting, you know, $100,000, $150,000 in revenue, but by the time we serviced all the stuff, it wasn't that big of a profit margin. We also at the time had imagined, we had hoped, I mean, this is back in 2003, we thought there were going to be a bunch of Tai'is. It seemed like an obvious thing to us. And then we envisioned a national network, and that we could all network our advertising. We could also probably get some savings on content by sharing some of these stories. And in the US, they've done such a thing. They've started the media consortium among all the different independent publications there. So that's a long-winded way to say, we built something that never expected to rely on advertising for more than a third of its revenues. Right now, it's more like maybe a fifth. And we prayed for some evolutions in the internet publication scene that didn't happen right away. But now that I see these guys up here at the table with me, I think maybe we might have some business to discuss afterwards. I think an ad network amongst sites like this could create the critical mass. If you could have one-stop shopping where you bought an ad on all four of these sites, that would be pretty cool, right?
It's part of the problem. As you say, the problem of Canada, which is it's small market.
It is, and not only small market, but big regional identity differences, right? You know, like does somebody Quebec's the obvious, you know, right? But even does somebody selling something in Manitoba want to give the same message, you know, mm-hmm. in Vancouver? So what I think is really interesting about the three of us, and maybe Wilf will make the case that he's part of this club too, but I think the three of us really consciously set out to create a website that would reach influentials. And you were able to do it with the internet because your costs were low. And the influentials would find you. They'd self-select out, right? And my wife's a professor, and the Globe and Mail is constantly trying to give her the paper just because they want to say that she gets it. You know, they want that demographic. The Tai'i readership has better educated readers than the Globe and Mail because we've surveyed them, but they make less money. So I don't know what that means, except that we have some tenuous claim to reaching influentials. And I think that there could be such a thing as a network of influentials-focused internet sites. That, and you're in, Wilf. I mean, I'm not keeping you out. I'm just saying, you know, I'm not sure that you have more of a...
But that's tough, though, because that's an even smaller market.
It's smaller, but look at it this way. If you were the Globe and Mail, and I've actually proposed this to them, so I'm not speaking out of school, but if the Globe and Mail wants to make a sale on its internet site in British Columbia, and you can use geo-targeting and all that stuff to do that, and they want to toss the Tai'i in and maybe on top of that sale as a premium, and they feel like having the Tai'i tossed in helped them get the union sale, right? and they want to give us, therefore, a cut in the sale. I've eliminated my cost of sale. They've done all the prospecting. They've closed the deal. They've made a sale they wouldn't make, and yet their customers reaching more influentials in BC. So I think that's the role that these startups are going to play. I like to think of it as a media ecosystem. We're not here to replace the big charismatic, you know, fauna that's roaming the land, but we're here to symbiotically coexist with them in some way, right?
Give me, and quickly before I move on to Will, give us a sense of your cost, though. You pay your reporters? David?
Oh, I'm sorry, I thought you were asking.
Yeah, I just want to get a sense of your
cost.
Yes,
we pay all of our reporters.
Like what a regular newspaper would pay?
At the beginning, no, but now, yes. Why? Not because our rates have gone up tremendously, but newspaper rates have just plummeted such, right? It was always an understanding at the TAI that we didn't want to be part of the problem. Uh-huh. And being part of the problem would be having $50,000 and creating a goal of, like, we're going to publish, 5,000 stories with that. And therefore you pit all the smart freelancers in the city against each other, and at the end of the day you've impoverished everybody. Uh-huh. And I know that Open File, which has arrived in Vancouver, and we're very happy to have them there, pays its writers very well, and it's just great because my writers write for Open File, and so now they can have a life. And this is, again, I think this is what I want to emphasize, is that what you see here is a sector starting to form. I thought it would form in 2 years. It looks like it's going to take more like 12. Uh-huh. But the point is, once the sector emerges, journalists can live within it and make a living. Advertisers can find their audiences, and hopefully we can stay in business.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's an interesting proposition, just because I remember when the Walrus started out, they were going to be paying gobs of money to all these impoverished journalists, and then realized that that wasn't really feasible.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask Wilf this last question, but I'm hoping to see some questions in the audience as well. So hopefully some of you have some, and because I'm running out of material here now. But I want to see some people starting to line up and ask some questions. I don't want to monopolize this conversation. So Wilf, I don't want to let you off the hook. I remember when you came on my show.
Yeah.
I think it was back in September.
It was
first launching. And
yeah.
And you talked the great talk about the whole geolocating thing.
Still do.
I know. But it's not there yet. I know you said you've got the plan, but originally was the idea that you wanted to wait a year? Because
Of course, we'd love to have gobs of money pouring in and advertisers knocking on our door, of course, but we knew that wasn't likely. I can share my experience with the advertising market, and it does say a lot about, I think, what we're all experiencing. I'll give you an example. We went to a big brand and said, would you like to partner with us? And they said, hell yeah. And this is true. I told the head of CTV to stick it, because I don't believe the metrics. I don't believe what they're telling me. And I love to support you little guys, so let's do that. And we got kicked down to the ad agency. And of course, they just said, yeah, uh-huh, yeah, sure, we'd love to do this. And the fact is, they don't want to do it, because they don't want to service 100 open files, because they don't get the markup. And they can't charge the creative services. And we in fact, do the job better than they do. And they don't want to do that. So I have to say, the ad agencies at this point are the biggest barriers to things like Open File. When we go out, and it's starting to change. They're starting to come on board. But we landed a TD for a year, very supportive. We've got a couple of other big blue chip corporations coming on.
Actual geolocating?
Geolocating is something that's the back end that I don't care if anyone knows about it. If they want to use it, that's great. They can search their postal code and find the stories around them.
But the actual tagging of advertising to a story.
Well, the idea with the geotagging and advertising is 2 to 3 years down the road. You need tremendous amount of volume in order for that to really work. You never like to come to a party and be the only person there standing beside the bar, So the idea here is that we're building for a mobile future. We believe that you can be on your iPhone or your iPad or whatever it is and look at an Open File site, and it will tell you exactly, it will know where you are if you opt in, and we can tell you all the stories literally around you, like on that corner, that happened there, et cetera. And there's all opportunities to show crime, where crime happened, traffic accidents, tell you a lot about your community. So that's the opportunity for geotagging. And they get that down the road. So we say to TD, hey, listen, come in and want the, and you're with us in year three, we're going to be able to tell you, so many people are talking about this issue in this neighborhood, perhaps you want to target your message to them. And
right.
I have to say that it's a really good conversation we're having with them. It's not pejorative. We're not trying to nail a user into targeting a message that they have to hear. We've said to the brands, and they know this is true, we have to give them information that they want to use. It's
right.
not, it's no point in just putting an ad up there that says the interest rate is this on the mortgage. It's, you know, this is what we're doing in your community, and you support us, we'll support you, et cetera. So that's the idea with our advertisers.
Okay. Now you have sponsors behind you, or you have a seed investor.
Yeah, we have a seed investor who came in initially, yeah.
Okay, so how much patience does he have?
Well, I think he's been very good to date. I mean, what I said to him
is, when do you have to start showing him the bucks?
Oh, like these guys? Like 6 months ago.
Okay.
So, but you know, we've created value in other ways that we're able to merchandise, that we can show, you know, the metrics of where we're going. I don't think in 9 months anyone expects
right.
a online news.
But are they saying to you 3 years, 4 years? When do they want to
start? Oh, yeah. No, I think, you know, regardless of what they're saying, what we know that we can get to the end of the runway in the next 2 years. So meaning we don't need any more money in the next 2 years, and we'll just be fine. So
I want to comment on that, actually.
Okay.
We've had an extraordinarily positive experience with our investors, who are not banging down the door and saying, pay us back. They said, we understand you're trying to build something that will take time. We understand that this is a sector that is growing, and we've been extremely fortunate to have investors who want to roll up their sleeves and who want to help build. This is not drop your money in and then show up again in 5 years and hope that you've made 300% on your money. These are people, for example, Jordan Banks, who I spoke to today, who runs Facebook in Canada and who built eBay, and literally 15 to 20 other super smart and accomplished people who are lending their expertise to the development of this company. And that is, I think, builds on what was said here today about this being a real community. We don't feel that either from our investors or from the large media companies or in fact, from anyone that we're being attacked or threatened in any way. In fact,
yeah.
it's very nurturing. And that's a really nice thing about operating
yeah.
here.
And the one thing I'll add, just very quickly, if you look at, there's a, you know, the, I don't know if you know the Mary Meeker slide, it's famous in our industry, and it's the internet advertising opportunity. And the fact is, in North America, ad dollars are not adjusted on the internet for time viewed. So meaning the amount of time spent on the radio, the amount of time spent on television, the advertising is adjusted. The internet, so new, you know, people are trying to figure it out. The views here and the advertising dollars are here. They will come up. It will come up when they feel that there's value. And we think that we're building products. I'm assuming I can speak for everyone. We're building that for that opportunity.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to turn it over to the our studio audience now. Go ahead.
Hi. Is this on? Yeah. Sort of a comment and a question. I don't know if it's because OpenFile is possibly the newest one on the block. But to me, you sound like the company that's most digital native and kind of truly what you'd do if you were starting a company in 2011 versus starting a company 10 years ago or a few. And this isn't really a criticism, but it's how it's coming across to me is that you've got the social media, the interaction, and you're using software tools and open source and that. Now, I imagine all of you guys are hearing him or thinking about this a lot, and I'm curious, how are you going to manage kind of software dealing with it, developing it as small companies? Because as well as the content, it seems to me you've got to have a lot of really good and innovative ideas to beat Bell and Shaw and Rogers with software, entertainment, news products.
Well, if they're so tough to beat, but who wants to answer this?
Well, I think that's a really good point. I mean, I call it the new digital divide. I mean, what was fantastic about the internet 10 years ago is that it was this level playing field. And as a matter of fact, internet-only organizations had a huge advantage over old media, because having worked inside the Vancouver Sun in the late 90s, early 2000s, you could see that the company was already sort of at war with itself. The internet side and the print side didn't understand each other, and certainly in the advertising side, and you know, they just didn't know why they should give away their content for free when they could get a big ad next to it on the paper, right? So we had a huge advantage in terms of we could just spend all day worrying about the internet and how to innovate on the internet. But then along came this Apple computer company, of all things, kind of blew everything up by it, you know, with its new platforms and its monetized app approach, right? And so suddenly you had to have these apps. And these apps were expensive to produce, and quality showed. It was like, you know, the difference between making a home movie and a real movie, people could tell. And it was the new digital divide, because how is the Taiyi going to compete? Well, we do have a pretty nifty mobile app, as I said now. And what may make the difference is, again, kind of the open source movement might come to the rescue again. There's this method now of making apps using HTML5, which it creates kind of a platform that you don't have to make one for every brand. Like, imagine how expensive that was. It would cost you $15,000 a piece to make an app, and you needed five different ones just to be mobile. That's how it looked 3 years ago. Well, now this one that we've made for around 10 grand looks like it'll do the job, period. So you just have to cross your fingers and hope that the open source movement keeps chugging along, because that's our only hope at competing that way. And on the social media side, you know, the Taiyi, it might look old-fashioned that we run long stories. They're very substantive, and you'd think that that's like really not well adapted to the new internet reality. Actually, social media saved the Taiyi. Because the 140-character tweet is usually pointing you to something that somebody thinks is absolutely definitive, important. You got to see this. So if we run a 2,000-word story full of hyperlinks, which, by the way, there's a novel internet idea that nobody does, hyperlinks. But we don't mind people leaving our site because we want our stories to be credible. So they're full of links. So, you know, the traffic we get through social media is just, that's where all our growth is, Facebook and Twitter. And we have 10,000 Twitter followers on the Taiyi, so.
We've been aggressively open source. We chose a WordPress platform and instead invested in a brilliant 23-year-old kid who can, you know, pulls in modules and recodes them, and it's, you know, ask and you shall receive with him. And that seems to have worked very well for us. And we had quite a hefty budget set aside to do some apps. And what kept coming back to us was, don't bother. You know, on the iPad we render so well in our WordPress form that on the browser that people are just going there. Same with Android. Playbook is out, we'll take another look at that and see if it's getting picked up. It'll be awfully nice to have, you know, be able to do flash ads, but we may not need to. It depends on the uptake. So we've stayed as open source as possible and invested in the people to work
with your
it.
Election coverage, though, did you use any kind of what one would describe as digitally native product, you know, some kind of interactive something, you know, a tool that wasn't just a story?
The one thing we have not done, and I get chided for it by our reporters and by Sue, is that we have not opened up to really active comments at this point. Mm-hmm. And the reason being is I just thought we didn't have the budget to monitor these things, and the danger of someone committing libel or whatever was too great for us in our early days. We feel more established. We feel we can now do that, and we'll be moving in that direction. And as such, we'll be absorbing, you know, some of the more active, digital native.
I'm thinking CBC Vote Compass or something.
Well, we did a seat projector in collaboration with Hill and Knowlton, and we plugged that in. We often put scribd documents in, and so we use whatever we can to enhance our coverage. But really, almost everything roots out of WordPress.
Okay, Jeff, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, we do some fun things like. These aren't apps, but, you know, head-to-head debates between two contributors where the audience can vote on who's winning, or We did this cool thing where it was win a breakfast with Romeo Dallaire. And the way that worked was the audience had to submit what they would talk to General Dallaire about if they were to win the conversation. Everybody else in the audience voted on who they thought should win that breakfast, and then we selected a winner who got a real live meeting with General Dallaire. We did something similar with Mayor David Miller, where this is an unbelievable story. The person who won the meeting with David Miller won because her story was that she was living here in Toronto. She didn't like the mayor's policies on small business because it made her husband's business go bankrupt. They moved out to Vancouver to go seek work or something, and she wrote a murder mystery in which the lead character, or in which a fictional character based on the mayor, David Miller, was murdered in the first few pages. And as she began to study Mayor Miller's policies, she began to find that he was green and progressive, and she kind of liked what he was doing. And so she wants to come out and meet David Miller to give him a copy of the book and apologize and thank him for his policies. So this, you know, this won, basically. She flew herself to Toronto to come meet him, and we recorded the whole thing and published the content in the meeting and so these kinds of blending the mm-hmm. online with the offline.
Okay, let's get to our next question.
Hi, guys. So I'm hoping my question's hard enough for you, Will, but I'm not sure. So I'm looking at you guys, and you're four white guys sitting behind this table. So I'm wondering where all the women are.
Not just women, but we have a huge problem on our side. I agree. I was saying this to my wife when on our way here. It is kind of sad that when we started Open File, we were really happy about the bar being lowered and that, you know, more publishers could get online. It just couldn't, a bunch of white, wealthy men who are in control, and then here a bunch of white guys again now starting it. So we have plans to try to solve that problem in the outreach of our actual reporters and our communities, which I actually just don't want to speak to right now because it involves a sponsor and they're pretty close and I don't want to say anything now, but we recognize that is a huge problem for us. I will be honest, I think we're far too white, far too Caucasian, and we're not covering a lot of the communities that we should cover. That being said, some of it takes initiatives, and that means dollars going into places that and larger investigations that we can't afford to do, but that's not an excuse. I'm just telling you that was not why that's why we haven't done it from day one, but we're well aware of that, and it's something our editorial team is trying to change dramatically.
Anybody else want to flagellate themselves?
Well, I just want to mention that the co-founder of the TAI, the person who was there at the beginning as my business director, the TAI's business director, not mine, is Michelle Hoare. She could do just as good a job of explaining what we're about as I am, but other reasons, she's not here. But so the TAI, we recognize that it's funny. I think it's a problem in general with investigative political type journalism. It does seem to be male dominated, except that if you walked into the TAI newsroom, you'd see a bunch of young people, and about two-thirds of them are women. And so that tells me that the middle-aged male complexion, white complexion of journalism is not going to be lasting too much longer, based on what I see.
Our middle-aged men are all on the sales side. Most of our newsroom is women. As I said, Susan Allen is the executive editor. Kathleen Harris is a senior reporter. Liz Thompson, Sonia Bell. So I'm actually always struck by how many more good women candidates came forward to cover politics, which was not the case when I was coming out of J school. I didn't really focus a lot on racial or religious diversity. I went for geographical. I wanted to have people from all over Canada, so I have people from down east. I have a good number from BC and Alberta. and from Southern Ontario and Quebec, so that that way at least we had people who really understood the regions more than perhaps.
Okay, I'm starting to feel sorry for middle-aged men. We're kind of getting close on time, so these three people are gonna ask their questions and then we'll call it a night, so go ahead, please.
For those of you who were working journalists and became entrepreneurs, what do you know now that you didn't know then when you got into getting into the business side of things? And what do working journalists or younger journalists need to understand more about the business side?
That's a good question. Who wants to answer that?
The first thing I realized is probably what a pain in the ass employee I was, knowing what it's like to manage people. I think there is not a great understanding of the value of journalism online, and that it's not valued all that well right now in terms of pure dollars. And we give our reporters metric bonuses, so they do get an idea of, we pass it right on. So for instance, if they get a certain amount of page views because they're sending their story around to people in their community or their audience, that does us good, but we also show true value there that this is actually what you get for those many more pages in terms of dollars. And I think it's not a great sum of money. And I think people are always shocked by that, about what it takes to sort of make money just on a pure click play, clicks. And I will add that, to walk into an advertiser and not have to make a pitch, meaning I can go in there and say, hey, listen, advertise with us, you really need 20 to 30% of the internet penetrated audience in Canada. So that's like 3 million people visiting, unique monthly visitors a month visiting your website. And in a country this small, not even the size of the state of California, that's really difficult to do. So I think on what journalists should know at this point is that it's hard. On just a pure click play on that type of advertising model that most people run by, how they value the journalism.
Did anybody else want to add to that before we move on?
Yeah, I think about this stuff a lot. I think I was well prepared for this because I started out as a freelance magazine writer, and that was just about as exotic and as impossible as being an online writer today. But I did work in some newsrooms, and what I would say is that the internet blew up the old idea of being a journalist. People should just forget what newsrooms taught about being a journalist. Think of it this way. If you managed to make your way into a newsroom, you would make your money in the newsroom, and you'd make your reputation in the newsroom. And so, if you did well that day, someone would come around and notice it, and they'd give you something else to do, and they'd keep paying you more money to do it. So your reputation was in this enclosed world. And that's over now, right? So now what happens is that you make your reputation on the internet by writing for the mark for free, unless you're one of the 10% who makes money over there. But I mean, you write for free, but you do it to build your reputation. And then you figure out a way to convert your reputation into money somewhere else. This is a very tricky little maneuver, but I can guarantee you that the only journalists who are going to survive are the ones who know how to do that. And so you see this new animal on the land, and they completely populate the mark. And they're people who make their money doing something else. They're professors, they're teachers, they ghostwrite NGO reports. I don't know what they do, but I call them engaged public intellectuals rather than journalists. And they're thinking all the time, and they're trying to get smarter all the time, usually about one or two areas. And that means that one of these days, when iPolitics needs an expert on the Arctic politics, that name comes to mind because somebody read their stuff on the mark. They made their reputation somewhere else, and so maybe they get a paid assignment to go to the Arctic. So just think about that, how the identity's just been completely teased apart. And now everybody has to figure out how to build up their reputation over here and make their money over here and do their journalism sometimes in a third place.
Okay, next question.
Just to come back to the monetization aspect for a minute. Jeff, I think you mentioned you saw The Mark as kind of almost like a production studio, and that traditional media outlets are really are desperate for content. And then Will, you mentioned that OpenFile, 80% of its material gets picked up by traditional media. I don't know if you meant directly reproduced or just the story gets picked up.
Just nicked, like the assignment editor looks at it and says, signs one of their reporters to it.
Right. Yeah. Well, I guess, Jeff, what percentage of, how do they pay? What percentage of your revenue comes from traditional media picking up what you produced? And I guess, Will, I don't know if you're actually paid for any of your content, but how viable is that as a revenue source?
The models vary. So in some cases, it's provide content to a traditional media player in exchange for exposure, which is not worth very much. In other cases, it's provide the content to the traditional media player and get some sort of revenue share, which is much more common. In other cases, if the content will be, say, exclusive, or if it's targeted at a specific vertical and it comes with an advertiser, then companies will actually pay per piece to procure that content from a company like The Mark. That mix is shifting and really depends. But it also depends on the willingness of that media company to pay and their ability to monetize it after they have paid. We've had some positive experiences. We've had some negative experiences where we feel we just don't get any value from it. And that's just the game that we're playing, trying to figure out how to make that work most effectively.
For us, we have several models, and we have partnerships that we're launching this fall with several big media outfits. We provide a service to them by outreach. So people suggesting stories through their platform. So we did something with Canada.com and the 7 Post media papers where they wanted to suggest election stories that mattered to them and their community. It came to us, we handled it, and we pushed it back to them, and then they got a choice of printing the stories, running them, and there's all fees for that based on scalability, and there's also revenue share opportunities. I will say, though, that the one thing that's really great is that, this whole talk that newspapers are going to die, I just don't see that. I see someone like the Globe and Mail as this great ocean liner that's moving along, and they're a great brand, and they're going to need guys like us to be the tugboats alongside to add value to that big brand. And if we can get some of their users and show the value of what we're doing to some of those users, I think that's great. So. That's what we're looking to do when it comes to the big partners.
Okay, and there's still two people. Go ahead.
Hello. One of the difficulties, I think, of being an online organization is creating all of this wonderful, lovely content and then having no one read it. So how important is driving traffic to each of your organizations, and what are some of the strategies that you use to get as many eyeballs as possible on the amazing content that you create?
Who wants to answer that, James?
Traffic is huge.
It's huge, as in you have huge traffic,
no,
or it's huge.
Traffic is consumes it consumes my every thought at least far too often. it's what tools we use. We use as much social media where possible, Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn. LinkedIn has, for our market, has actually been proven to be quite strong. We also, it's old-fashioned retailing. We've used the loss leader. I've been fortunate to have Don Newman and Lawrence Martin and Bob Plamondon occasionally give us a column, and when we do, it gets picked up by National Newswatch or Bork or Taiyi, and we get a lot of referrals that way. And so, and the first time that happened, it actually kind of surprised us, but we pretty quickly became addicted to that way of driving traffic, and that. Actually, when we went back on our business plan from 18 months ago and revisited from stuff that Chris Waddell and others and Josh Benton had talked about, in the freemium models, that's absolutely essential, is to have you know, have something that you hang in the window that brings people to your site and then gets them to, you know, you ideally get 2, 3, 4, or 5 pages out of them. We, at one point, prior to the election, we were averaging sort of 4.2, 4.3 page views, which per visitor, which was great. It's gone down because of the election. But
can you give me a sense of the size of the like? What for you is a good amount of people, like a top story for you? How many people are reading that?
At this juncture, and we're still, you know, very much in our nascent stage. A good day would be anywhere from 6 to 10,000 visitors, and we had when we had some polling data, we would have days with 30,000, 40,000, 1,000 plus people on the site at any at any given point during the day. So I mean, you can have these big spikes and drops.
But, okay.
For our size, we need to have that kind of traffic.
Okay, was there one more question here? Okay, and then we'll wrap up.
Okay, sure. With the level of public participation and even partnerships required for your organizations, how many of you actually employ a dedicated community manager to deal with your public? And I mean beyond social media.
Yeah, we have somebody who does that, yeah. I mean, her job includes that, but we actually call her the reader engagement. We're kind of thinking up new names, actually, for her. We want it to sound cooler than that. But, like, you know, it sounds like somebody Reader's Digest had working for them 20 years ago. But, I mean, reader engagement, and so it's many, she does many interesting things. Like, she does the social media, but she also, like, created a book out of the best of our food writing. She did an on-demand, print-on-demand book, and then she gave it away as like a premium. And so she's always figuring out ways to engage our readers. I mean, to go back to that previous question, it's not just traffic for us. It's what kind of traffic? And again, as I said, we want a regional community that seems interested in our values. We want them to come back over and over again. So one interesting way of reaching those people is we have a newsletter, a daily and weekly newsletter with all of our headlines. We don't publish tons of stuff. We publish 4 features a day and maybe 10 blog items a day. And so we have probably 25,000 people get that newsletter. And that reminds them that we exist. It's like finding a newspaper lying on the bus bench, right? And so this woman, Shannon Smart, who does this for us, spends a lot of time fiddling with the newsletter too and putting interesting messages in there and trying to come up with contests to get people to sign up on the newsletter.
Anybody else want to add to that before we? All right, I've been asked for a small short.
Yeah, just one quick question for you guys. I think it's terrific, the original Canadian content and journalism that you're doing. My parallel to that is with Huffington Post now coming to Canada under the AOL Canada brand. Are we at a point where we should start thinking about regulation or Canadian content regulations on the internet, excuse me, for news organizations? I think we're all in the same game here, and so I'm just curious as to how Huffington Post fits in as a potential co-opetition partner or adversary.
It's a good question. I was wanted to ask that question too. They've already started picking up people from the Globe and Mail. They're ready to go. So anybody have any thoughts on competition from the Huffington Post?
You know, there's a lot of noise out there. I don't think the Huffington Post is going to kill us. You know, it's a struggle every day. You have a lot of choices online to go to, and you just have to create a value. I don't know if regulating them is even possible. But from our point of view, we welcome it. I mean, I really feel that, you know, the most, especially in the last sort of 6 months, most of our traffic after Facebook and Twitter comes from other news sites that have linked to us. And, you know, we have a good return rate. So that shows us that when people can discover us through other products online, and if they like us and we're doing a good job, I hope they'll come back. So at least from my point of view, I welcome it.
I think you've asked two questions. I mean, one is the impact of the arrival of the Huffington Post, and frankly, is somewhat of the question is something that obviously is very important to the mark because it's a very similar model. But ultimately, the Huffington Post is very much here, right? The Huffington Post gets 1.4 million unique visitors to its site from Canada every single month. That's significantly larger than everybody sitting here, and bigger than many of the well-established TV-based media companies in this country. I mean, it's huge. Now they're gonna, they'll turn up the heat and they'll probably grow, and they pose a real threat, I think, to the much larger news sites that are dependent on traffic. I mean, I don't think The Mark, for example, will get hit on its traffic as a result. I think the big portals and I think some of the bigger news sites will feel it. They're gonna be competing for eyeballs and they'll be competing for ad dollars, and they will be fierce competitors. On the question of regulation, philosophically, personally, I don't agree with it. I don't think it really protects us in the long run. I think competition makes us fight harder. Necessity is the mother of all invention, and I too welcome it. I think it's going to elevate, hopefully, elevate the level of competition. Maybe not the level of discourse, but certainly the competition for competing digitally.
That's a great way to end it. There we see the generational divide. I want to thank all of you for participating in a really thoughtful and interesting discussion. Jeff Anders of The Mark, James Baxter of iPolitics, David Beers of The Taiyi, Wilf Dinnick of OpenFile. Thank you very much. It was a great conversation. Now I'm going to ask back John McClellan.
Thank you to our moderator, and thanks to all of you for coming out on this cold and nasty evening. We hope we'll see you all here again next fall when we start our next series. And in the meantime, please join us upstairs for some refreshment and more talk about this and other matters.